Welcome to this week's Casterbris Podcast with a K, available on Casterbris, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo.
With me this week is James McLean. My name is Christian Corley. There's no Brian turnover this week, unfortunately. We've kind of been trialed by illness this week with the podcast. We nearly didn't make it. We have, though. We're here now.
We.
Well, you've been fine. You've been fit as a fiddle,
royal
haven't
we.
You?
I have, haven't I? Yeah. So I thought I'd point out it's a bit of a royal we there, isn't it?
Yes. Well, no, I was thinking of Brian as well. Brian's been ill.
Oh, of course, yeah. Brian's been ill as well. Yes, yeah. he's had some very nasty stuff. But I've got my cup of coffee.
Have you? Well, I finished my pint of orange juice waiting for you. So if my voice...
That's just too much. Pint of orange juice, that's obscene. Yeah, it's the sort of thing you'd do if you took over countries. You would sort of, once you took over the country and you had everything, you'd have a bath of milk, you'd have a tower of gold, and you'd have a pint of orange juice to celebrate, just because you'd be in excess, wouldn't you?
I don't think I'd have a pint of orange juice to celebrate taking over a country.
Well, you just don't think big.
Okay. All right, so to push on then with this week's Casterbris podcast with a K. Last time, just incidentally, and before we get into the swing of things, last time we asked if our dear listeners would be able to put together a tune for us, didn't we?
Yes.
Anyone would be able to contribute. We've had a couple sent through, and we're going through those at the moment, so we will be in touch. If anyone else wants to put their heads to the notation paper, that's probably... not the right allegory to use. But if anyone else does want to contribute a tune for the podcast, which we'll be using over the coming months, then by all means, please do so. Drop me an email, christian@casterbris.com, with your contribution attached, and we'll let you know what we think. If there's anything else we can, you know, if we can wiggle it around a little bit towards more along the lines of what we're looking for. So to the podcast and to the news this week. There's been, you know, in these quiet times, you think, oh, we're not going to get any Doctor Who news. Yes, there's been quite a lot. We've been busy on Casterbris. We've got a backlog now of things that we want to talk about. One of the things that we want to talk about today here on the podcast is the old sexual doctor. This assertion by Stephen Moffat that the Doctor has always been sexual. He was talking to IGN about Doctor Who and Sherlock, and on the matter of Doctor Who, he was said that he was asked about these questions about whether Doctor Who is more sexual, and he says, I won't do the accent. I mean, people talk about...
He always
sex.
Says that, doesn't he? Before he says any interview, or any interview that you tell us that he says, he always says at the beginning, oh, I'm not going to do the accent. And then he does his tragic accent for like a couple of sentences. Yeah. And then he goes back to this sort of northern brogue.
Indeed, yes.
Sorry, so what did he say after that?
He said, I mean, people talk about sex in Doctor Who. I heard someone say that to me. You've sexualized the Doctor. I said, where? In what episode? What great episode are you watching? He went on and on, and then said, I mean, Matt Smith's Doctor in particular just flails in the presence of women. But... at the same time, it's a factor of the canon of the show that the Doctor was a married man and had children.
No, it's not.
No, it's not. I don't remember him being married and having children. We know he had a granddaughter. That's a different thing. We know that he flirts. We know that he falls in love. We know that he has a full range of response in that.
But he's always pushed this, hasn't he? I mean, we were saying this before we came on. The Doctor dances. He was there pushing this more than Russell T. Davis was. The allegory of Doctor dancing obviously being about coitus, the Doctor coitus. And I think it's I do hate it when people do this. They start making assertions to suit what they want to believe. And I know we all do it. I know he's not rare in doing it. And I think the only thing I'd agree with him on is that the Doctor is very human, because I mean he is meant to embody our righteous values to a degree, isn't he? He's anti-establishment. He's there for the common man. He's unique. But bottom line is that he's there to help people because he cares. Now, if you care, you are human. And if you're not human, you're showing human emotion. So therefore, you could extrapolate from that X, Y, Z, he would be someone who could fall in love. And I think he can fall in love. But the question is, is the love and is the social hierarchy of love the same? And I don't think Moffat can say it is, apart from what he tries to put in there, or, you know, maybe what's in extended media. But by and large, there is nothing to suggest that this marriage on does Leela and Andred actually get married? I know they say they get married in the books, but in the actual show,
I think she holds his hand.
Yeah,
I'll see the blue and says she's staying.
Yes,
I'm always interested in how much say Andred had in that.
Yes, well, I mean, as the actors said, you know, it was something they had sort of pretty much forced into to because they thought it was good and it wasn't really there. So, yeah, I think it's I think he's pushing too much to make his own point. I would say that if you go to Russell T. Davies's argument that, you know, canon is what people remember, and from that you could say what people understand. And I would say prior to the 2005, the people would not say the Doctor is someone who's been married. He's not someone who falls in love, even though there are arguable circumstances like the Aztecs. Some people would argue is in love some people argue with Joe Grant. Some would even argue with romance. There's ones that you could argue. But generally speaking, people would not have that viewpoint on the Doctor. These days, I think they would say he falls in love. I would still say there's a question of the coitus, and I would certainly say there's a question of things like marriage. And I really do hope they don't, because, you know, as we know, marriage was originally, you know, in as we said before, about land, essentially, when marriage was in its vogue. It wasn't about love, and that sort of came on later. So it becomes a bit twee if Gallifrey has marriage as well, and it's such a... Does it mirror our history in that way? I don't know. Yeah, I think he's probably making a bit. I think he enjoys stirring, to be honest. He knows that's going to cause a few ripples. It's going to cause a bit of news. It's going to keep Doctor Who floated in the net sphere with complaints and grumbles. So I think he plays a bit of a game.
Yeah, I think he does as well. It's funny that we're talking about this on Valentine's Day, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? Yes, absolutely. We should get a life, as we were told for the last podcast.
Were we?
Yeah, in one of the notes we were told get a life, or because we were discussing...
Was it because we were talking about female doctors?
Yeah, get a life. Yeah, because
someone didn't listen, did they?
No, they didn't listen, but they decided that, you know, they had time to type get a life in Doctor Who forum. They're obviously reading, but, you know.
Yeah. Oh, God. Women scriptwriters are strangely scarce in Doctor Who. Now, this isn't anything new, because it's all... almost always been the case, apart from a few. We can reel them off in one hand, can't we? I think it's Barbara Clegg, Jane Baker, who, you know, as half a Pippin, Jane Baker, she doesn't really count as a full woman either, or a full scriptwriter, I beg your pardon. Rona Munro and Helen Rayner, and that's it. Now, since Stephen Moffat took over the running of Doctor Who, which he was in charge and commissioning scripts in 2009. The show, obviously, his era started in 2010. In that time, there've been no women scriptwriters. Rusty Davies had one in Helen Rayner, but she's working as script editor a lot. And we've got Barbara Clegg, Enlightenment, that's 1982-83, and Rona Munro, Survival, and which I think I've just said, and Pip and Jane Baker, obviously. With focusing on here, throughout the 80s, some such classics as Time and the Rani. There is a shortage of female writers for Doctor Who on TV, isn't there?
Yes.
The novels have been more fortunate.
And they've been very good as well. I mean, Kate Orman is one that springs immediately to mind as a fantastic Doctor Who writer.
Well, there's Jenny Colgan's Scottish set Doctor Who with the 11th Doctor, which came out a few years ago, which I can't remember the title of at the moment. It's very good, though. It's rather a clever little story, although it's not a little story at all. But that was one of the big hardback novels. Obviously, she's well-known as a chick lit author. We've heard recently that Debbie Moon, who has her own range of books, is... interested in writing Doctor Who, but I suspect that would probably be in the novels area were that to come to pass.
But I mean, could we say, is there a shortage of female script writers period? I mean, and I've not researched this, so I'm just asking as a question. I mean, is it indicative of Doctor Who,
or the industry?
Is it indicative of the industry?
It's a very good question. I haven't researched it either, because I don't watch an awful lot of television, so to do so would have possibly been silly. But I do. I mean, there are well-known female scriptwriters, aren't there?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
There's Lucy Gannon, created Soldier Soldier, and she was the brains behind Frankie, for instance, the Eve Miles show, among other things. So, yeah, you know, there are female scriptwriters working in prominent positions with prominent careers. So it's... there is, though, at the same time, there is a sense of... And I don't want to say that it's a club, because I don't for one moment think that all these writers sit down and talk to each other and plan what they're going to do. You know... I know that I've heard that some of them don't like some of the others, so that, you know, that isn't going to happen. But since 2005, I mean, a largely male Doctor Who scriptwriting community has developed. And, you know, a lot of them came from the Virgin and BBC Books.
Mm.
But at the same time, a lot of them didn't. A lot of them come from their own shows or just working in the industry on whatever show. Well, I mean, it's kind of frustrating, though, isn't it? Because, you know, there isn't... It's not about box ticking. It's about just finding the right people to do the story. But if you look and see how many women have been involved, then clearly there is a bit of an imbalance with the rest of what's going on in television, which does seem strange.
I think you could say it's certainly an imbalance with what we see, as you say, in the industry... the rest of the Doctor industry, whether you look at Big Finish, where, say, there's not necessarily just female writers, but you've got directors there on board as well, mm-hmm. and as you say in the books. I don't know whether that's just, it's just unfortunate, because I mean, they don't actually have a plethora of writers on Doctor Who each series. There is the staple names keep coming back.
Yeah.
So if I was to be devil's advocate in their defence, you'd say, well, you're talking about four or five writers, maybe each series tops, with Moffat taking the, you know, a good third quarter of the storylines, and then the rest being farmed out to people like Gatiss or, there's loads of names I can't even think of at the moment. I think you're right, though. I think I it's not about box ticking, but it does feel like that the show. I don't know. It's hard, isn't it? Because you're cautious to sound like a backseat driver, because we don't know what goes on in the Doctor Who offices. We don't know how many scripts they look at. We don't know if they get many scripts from women. We don't know whether they ask men but don't ask women.
Well, they don't take unsolicited scripts anymore.
Oh, well, that's true, yes.
Women aren't going to be sending them scripts. They're going to be approaching agents.
Well, no, but that's what I'm... But agents will still pass on a script, surely. I don't know. It's an interesting one. I find, especially with Doctor Who now being such a far more balanced show so far as it is, has a very strong female audience as well, mm-hmm. as male audience, you would think there would be a fair few female script writers who would be looking at it. Yeah, no, I've come to a decision on this because I've had to have an hour over this. I think they should be trying to tick a box and get some women writers in. Not because I think the show is sexist, but I think the show, the basis of Doctor Who has always been about fighting the establishment. And if there is a certain anti-feminism in the establishment of television, then Doctor Who should be trying to, in itself, live up to it, the values of its character, and trying to become an entry model for women writers.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it is probably harder for women writers. I don't doubt that.
Okay.
So maybe, yes, I think it should be. I think they should have more women writers, because I think they're in a position where they've got the power to offer, spots for new writers, which other shows might not have the certainty to do so, because their commissioning could be a little more tenuous. You're worried about bringing in new blood that you don't know, it might not work. But with Doctor Who, you can probably get away with it. So I don't know. Oh, it's funny, isn't it? This has been a battle of the sexes month, talking about these sort of things.
Yes, it has.
In a weird way.
Yeah, it's odd that. It's completely unintentional.
No, it is absolutely unintentional. But it is genuinely interesting, because
It's certainly eye-opening.
Yes. Yes, I know. And yet at the same time, you're cautious about backseat concluding on stuff that you know nothing about. And it's just like, you know, why are there so few Doctor Who female writers? But I don't know.
Okay, well, we'll move on. We'll move on to a topic that is, if it isn't at one that's regularly discussed at your dinner table during 2014, it certainly will be by the end of the year. And that's the issue of Scottish independence and how this might affect Doctor Who. James, do you think Scottish independence will affect Doctor Who?
No, I don't at all. I don't think... I mean, this is, again, going into social politics now rather than sexism, another minefield. I would always say, from an English person's perspective, I know I've got a Scottish name, but I was born in England. From an English person's perspective, the nationalistic issues between Scotland and England, if we ignore the economic ones and all the politics at the moment, I can understand why some Scottish people have a frustration or an anger or a slight resentment to English people. Mm-hmm. And yet I don't think it's necessarily the same the other way around. And I don't think this is because English people are thicker skinned or any stupidness like this. I mean, basically Scotland had a history of feeling, whether you want to believe it's rightly or wrongly, feeling slightly aggrieved with things that have happened with England, because England always carried a lot of power within this island. So I think there's a lot of issues, there is a lot of resentment in Scotland over stuff that England has done, which is bolstering the national issue here. And I don't think the English people totally understand it, because I don't think the English people particularly care. It's sort of like, you know, I don't want to sort of use a parents and son category, because I don't think the English are like the parents. But it's like, you know, if you've annoyed someone a lot and they carry that anger, but because they've not annoyed you, you've been annoying them, you don't carry the same anger. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of shocked to find that they're quite annoyed about you. And I've heard a lot of things. I used to live in Blackpool, and, you know, I'd heard of Scottish people, you know, come a match down and ripping English fags off the windows, which is terrible. And I'd hope if English people did that in Scotland, that would be terrible as well. I remember the Daily Record, I think it was one of the national Scottish papers when it was the one of the World Cups, and Scotland was out, and it was England versus Argentina. It was England versus Argentina. They were telling the Scottish people to support Argentina.
Well, 1998.
Then. And they were sort of saying, you know, look at the difference. Would you like this gorgeous Argentinian model or this ugly British bulldog? And it was that sort of joke. And it was, you know, lighthearted. But there's no doubt there's a little animosity there. But my point being, I know I'm rambling here, is that I don't think the English side has any issues with Scotland per se.
No.
So whether Scotland is not part of England or not, I don't think they will particularly be bothered whether it's got a Scottish showrunner and a Scottish lead actor. I don't think it would affect them. They don't see Scotland in that sort of way. If it was the other way around, I think a lot of Scottish people wouldn't care either. But there might be a few who might have a little more resentment. I don't know. So I think, certainly the BBC is going to give a damn.
Exactly.
I was just saying, you know, they're not going to suddenly cancel all the American American programs because of the War of Independence. And, you know,
it was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago, true. But, you know, they're not going to cancel all the... all the American programs because, you know, British people didn't like the Bush era particularly, you know. it doesn't happen.
No. Well, I mean, you know, just on what you were saying earlier about English people and Scots, we're all very interrelated as well. And this will possibly be a bit extra information for you if you're listening in USA, Canada, or Australia. Maybe not Australia, New Zealand, but in the USA and Canada. We're very closely integrated with Scottish people. They're all over the United Kingdom. They're particularly all over England because a lot of them have got jobs in England. There's a larger proportion of Scots live in England than live in Scotland. And this isn't, you know, this isn't a dig or anything like that. That's how it works. That's how economies work. That's how economies develop. That's how jobs work. People move south for work. People move to London from the northeast. And that gets me onto another thing. It's here in the northeast. I'm speaking largely personally, but I know I'm not alone in this. Complete disdain for how the country's run and the governments in London, of whatever party flavour they are, whatever mm-hmm. colour they are, because they live in this insane bubble. And I think a lot of the Scottish grievances comes from that. The Scots have this advantage of having their own country, so they could theoretically leave the Union. But to do so would be cutting their nose off to spite the face, in my opinion. And we'll find out later in the year, but certainly I don't think there's any danger of Doctor Who being affected by having a Scottish writer and a Scottish lead actor, both of whom live in the UK.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think
in England, I should say.
I agree with a lot of that. I don't think there's. I think, you know, I mean, I personally feel if Scotland leaves, it's a great shame, and I put a lot of the blame on that in the fact that. A lot of it on the English side, really, for not really addressing some of the upsets and frustrations that have happened, that have been in Scotland. Mm. And as you say, and in England, you know, as you say, government is so insular to London. The further away from London you get, the less feeling that you are being represented properly.
Yeah. We only have to look at the floods, don't you?
Yes, like, absolutely.
Everyone in Cornwall and the southwest.
Well, Cornwall's felt been like trying to become independent for a long time.
Well, there is that as well, isn't there? Yeah, but no, this sensation, this feeling that they had of utter frustration that no one was listening to them and addressing their problems. As soon as Buckinghamshire and Surrey gets flooded, Dave Cameron's straight there.
Yes, exactly, yes. It's terrible, and there is that real feeling, and whether it's true or not, that does... And then when you actually have your own national identity on top of that, which, as you say, the Cornish feel they have their own national identity in their own way as well, which is probably similar to how the Scottish feel and how the Welsh have felt as well, and the Irish, is that there is a sort of an arrogance from Westminster, which I agree probably comes from both parties, or a blindness to the frustration. So, yeah, with the whole thing with the Scottish national identity and the possible parting of Scotland, I don't blame Scotland. I hope they don't. I think it's a shame because I think as the world gets smaller, I would like to have seen Britain become closer and more together. I think it's a great shame that you know yourselves up in the north could have a different lifestyle to someone, you know, 10-15 miles across a border and be represented differently, even though, you know, we're all people, we're all the same. So I think it'd be a shame, but I think, yeah, you know, if we're getting political, I think the sad thing is that if the English had been a little more receptive to some of the frustrations I think Scotland's had with England, maybe we could have had a more sensible situation now where people were a little more level-headed. But now, you know, I think from both sides, there's a lot of national emotion, which is always a problem. But yeah, it's not going to affect Doctor Who. I don't think people are that silly.
No. Okay, let's skip on then to Ben Wheatley. He's the talented director who's been working on the first two episodes of Doctor Who. Series 8, first two to feature Peter Capaldi as the Doctor. I still can't quite get over, even though we sat live podcasting at that time. Anyhow, he was speaking to Film Drunk about mainly about his films, but he was quizzed about when he's Doctor Who, how his Doctor Who's going. And he said, I've got two more weeks shooting Doctor Who, which hopefully is going to go in July. Now, we've been told by a couple of different sources that Doctor Who is more than likely to be airing late August, probably the August bank holiday for the first episode, which makes sense because Let's Kill Hitler aired that weekend, and it did very well indeed. There's been a few interpretations of this. A lot of people seem to think that this in July is some sort of cast in stone kind of definitive date for Doctor Who to air. It seems extremely unlikely to us. Possibly he's going to get to preview it. That's when the episode gets locked. But maybe it's going to get previewed in July, perhaps. Maybe it's going to go to Comic-Con. Who knows? But the new series is probably not going to be airing before August. What say you, James McLean?
I don't think it'll come before August. I remember hearing rumours that the BBC were eager for an Easter special, but that was pretty much downplayed as a no-go. Mm. So, yeah, I think as much as
people want. Can you think of any series that have launched in July?
No.
Certainly no primetime blockbuster series have launched in July.
No, I don't think so. I mean, August is a bit odd, but then...
August is odd, but it's been done before. And we're going to get 13 weeks, which is going to be, if it's August, last weekend in August, and we're going to get, you know, through to late November for Doctor Who, which means we're going to get dark nights for Doctor Who, because we're getting a full run of 13 episodes, aren't we? So that's exciting. Doctor Who with dark nights. That's like
that's 2000. That's what you love.
It is what I love. Yeah. I mean, when did it last happen? 2009, for one night only. I suppose it happened last year as well. But, you know, classic era, Doctor Who, Dark Knights. Yeah, come on. I might even start going to football again, just to get the full sensation. okay. So we don't think that's going to happen. You've probably noticed that we're rattling through the stuff this week. That's basically because we haven't got Brian with us.
Yeah.
He talks like this, Brian.
He does, doesn't he?
He does. He does.
It's a problem, isn't it? It's kind of good he isn't here, because there's been a lot of British stuff, you know, things like
yes.
Scotland. He's not really going
to
happen.
We'd have to explain Scottish independence.
I know. So.
And most of us don't understand it anyway. So.
No, I mean, you've seen so many reports now, so many people saying it's going to be bad for them, it's going to be good for them, it might be good for them, it might be bad for them. Yeah. I don't know.
It's going to be one or the other, though, I'm pretty sure.
Yes. Well, as I say, I mean, I just hope that it's they do it for practical common sense values than... You know, nationality is always a dangerous thing, isn't it? Because you can make so many mistakes on the basis of something which, in the end, is wonderful. Because I'm very nationalistic. I love being English. I love being British. But, you know, you can't really put that ahead of what's going to be helpful for you day by day. So yes. I hope they make the right decision in that sort of respect.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Okay. Recommendations time, James.
I finished the Cadiz. Finally,
the Flames of Cadiz.
Wild, the Flames of Cadiz. Yes, very interesting. It's a Mark Platt one. It's four parts, done like a classic Doctor Who. It's very well done. It's very well directed. It's we should mention it's Lisa Bauman, the woman,
a female director,
female director, okay. Who obviously was Bernice Summerfield. In
we probably shouldn't get into female directors.
No, we shouldn't, should we? But anyway, she directed it. It's William Russell, Caroline Ford, who take parts in narrating. And yeah, it was really good. It's kind of odd because the two parts don't really marry together very well. The first two parts is quite a very dark look at the Spanish Inquisition. Mm-hmm. And the second two parts is a more lighthearted, more in tone of the show look of Sir Francis Drake, all at the same period. But it feels very separated in those two parts, which I'm not sure whether I like or not, in the sense I kind of almost feel like it would have been better to have been either. But at the same time, it's beautifully written all the way through. Caroline Ford and William Russell are wonderful. I mean, Caroline Ford, I think she's a little underrated, to be honest. I mean, I remember when she was in Shakedown, in the VHS Shakedown in the 90s, and she didn't impress me particularly there. I think I felt she was struggling to find her character. Which I don't think particularly was her fault. I think it was quite a thin character, and I imagine the direction was, you know, I don't want to say amateurish, but it was, you know, limited, yeah. But in these audio plays, certainly, she's been fantastic. She's got a good range. She plays it out perfectly, and everyone thinks William Russell is fantastic in the audio. So, yes, I would certainly recommend it. They're both very good actors. It's a good writer, Mark Platt. You can't go wrong.
Okay, excellent, excellent. Brian has no recommendations for us this week because he's not here.
No, he hasn't. That's pathetic.
So, as you may know, if you're a regular listener, I purchased a bulk of Doctor Who's that I had either not seen, hadn't seen completely, or hadn't seen since they were first aired. And my most recent viewings have been, or since we last spoke, have been... We did Colony in Space last time. So it's been the Time Monster... and the Sunmakers.
Oh, crikey. Okay, that's interesting. I'm more interested in what you think of the Sunmakers, but Time Monster.
Time Monster. Intriguing, the Time Monster. I thought it was going to be a lot better than it was, but I wasn't disappointed by it. I think it has a couple of problems that the early on, I think it's episode two or towards the end of episode one, where it suddenly jumps to Atlantis. And not only is it jumping... more or less without warning, it's also switching from video to film.
Yeah.
So it's quite jarring. So it has that little problem. I think Ingrid's... Pitt's accent is absolutely impenetrable in places. But at the same time, I'm quite allured to her. it might be the way she's dressed.
Sexist.
It's not sexist. That's... Valentine's Day. The Master is absolutely brilliant in it.
So wait a second, because it's Valentine's Day, that validates you lusting over another lady other than your wife. You think that's a good Valentine's Day comment?
Well, since you put it like that, it probably isn't. Let's move on. Roger Delgado is brilliant as ever as the master.
Yes.
I like the fact that there's that time distortion thing going on, which we see again later on with the invasion of the dinosaurs.
Yeah.
As a whole, it's a little bit. I'd be interested in watching it in one go, to see how it sits together. Watching it nightly, possibly some problems that are in there don't stand out so well. Some of the supporting cast aren't great, and the baby Benton thing's a bit annoying more than anything else.
I think in a funny way, I mean, the Atlantis bits are so... They're rubbish.
Mm.
And thankfully, there's not many of them.
Yes.
And thankfully, even though there is in a way, because they appear quite prevalent for the last two episodes.
Last two episodes, yeah.
They don't really... I don't know. It is a really washy miss... Because there's some brilliant bits in it. I love the bits in the with the rather interestingly titled Tomtit. It is a Tomtit for that one. It's not mine.
Yes, it is.
It's a Tomtit, isn't it? That's good because Delgado's great in it. The second section, which is a hell of a lot of it in their TARDISes, is a bit of fun.
Yes.
There's that lovely little bit where he switches the Doctor off on the sound, which
Curse of the Fatal Death.
Which is yes, played a little
a lot
on that.
It, yeah.
Yes, that works so fantastically.
And of course, it's the Wox on the wall as well.
Yes, it's
interesting to see the Master's got Wox as well.
I know, but he has a different door. He comes in through the right.
He does at the other end, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And interesting links to the slide door of his outer side bit, which is interesting. Anyway, yeah, but it's an interesting concept.
I wonder if the Master and the Doctor ever have kind of Chinese cooking competitions.
They'll all fall out. They'd have to turn their TARDIS on their side. but yes, it's an interesting build. I like there's some silliness in it that you find often in the 70s, like the appearance of the various war eras attacking the unit troops. You kind of wonder why he didn't sort of go for, say, 1945 and just sort of obliterate them all or something, but he goes for men on horseback, thankfully. It's a very odd... It's an odd one. I don't particularly like it. I like bits of it, but it just doesn't sit well. And the ending, you know, as I say, the Atlantis is just...
It does feel
rushed.
A bit of a hodgepodge. It does feel as though there are some very good things in there, but they've all come from lots of different stories.
Yes.
It doesn't feel like a polished final thing. It was clearly far too ambitious, and they've clearly done a lot to make it work for TV. And in places it works fine, and in others it doesn't.
And it's kind of funny.
I don't even want to talk about the Flappy Dove thing.
I was just going to say, you know, given that is probably the most iconically godlike being in the entirety of Doctor Who, and the effects for it are just... I mean, it's a shame because, you know, these days you look at it and you think, you're an idiot. All you had to do was perhaps even do big flashing white light. You didn't need to have a body there.
Mm.
You could have made it totally non-corporeal and the audience would have bought it. So, you know, it's easy to say that with hindsight. But, you know, nowadays we look at these sort of things with a more of a minimalistic view as what can we get away with? And that didn't work at all. So, yes, it's a bit of a messy one. I know it's a fan for a lot of people, but it doesn't really work for me. And you said Sunmakers.
Sunmakers, yes.
Another interesting one.
Yeah.
How did you find it?
I found the collector to be quite annoying.
Yeah.
I find it... you know, there's this thing about playing Doctor Who straight, whether it's a comedy or whatever. You've got to play it straight, otherwise it doesn't work. And he's very borderline, isn't he?
Yes.
Fortunately, he's not in it too much for the first sort of two or three episodes. It's only when in the final episode where he gets prominent. So he's kind of focusing on Gather Hades, who again he's got it, but he's just a bit too much. He's very similar in his the character's similar in his the way he talks and everything with Garen.
Mm-hmm.
The following season or the season two seasons later in Cuthbertson's character in the Ribos operation, I found.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in some of the way he's pronouncing it, but I found him a little irritating. And that woman Marn was completely drab and couldn't really understand what the point of her was.
Mm.
The under people were okay. I think possibly they were kind of the decision to kind of rebel came a little bit too quickly. Mm-hmm. But on the whole, I enjoyed it. I thought it was really good.
That's interesting. I would postulate to you that it's an episode which I think would do well as a new series one. Mm-hmm. You know, something as a 40-minute episode. Because I mean, it's quite a nice, you know, it's a nice satire on you know, accountancy and the period.
Is it really? Life. I hadn't noticed.
No, I know, actually it is. You might not have noticed that. There's a lot of things, but it's just, again, it feels like it's too ambitious in different ways. To me, it feels bland. Right. There's too much of the standard Doctor Who fare there, of the running down empty corridors with a couple of troopers, which you get this a lot in Baker's era, because they obviously haven't got many people. So you'll have the two guards who'll be inept and fire and miss, and there'll be the slow moving vehicle of some sort.
That was is that what the steamroller from Austin Powers came from? Do you think?
Yes, I think possibly. it really is worth the. A parody. And then you've got everything else, you know, the underworld, back to the underworld, up to the stairs, down to the underworld. You know, you're going back toward A, B again, which is a very common Doctor. It's a nice idea. As you say, I quite like the collector because he just gives it a little bit of spark. And otherwise, it's a sort of fairly bland. It's a bland aesthetic. The characters, you say, are very flat. I enjoy Michael Keating in it. I think he's not in it enough, though, is he? No, he's not. He's not at all. Baker looks a little bit bored in it. It just doesn't, it's like a lot of that sort of era. There's a lot of stuff which just would probably work better as 40-minute episodes in the new series than as four parts where they just end up going backwards and forth.
He looks a little bored when he's with Leela and when he's with the people downstairs. When he gets upstairs, he's normal self. He's his usual, you know, he's like the early scene when he gets the 1,000 or 10,000 credits or whatever it is back from Hades. That's a great little scene. That's a good setup there, and I like the fact as well that he's clearly like this corporation boss. And again, we're going back to, I mentioned Garen earlier, another Robert Holmes story. Then you've got Morgus in the Cage of Andrew Zani, gets a similar sort of character, the Gatherer.
Yeah, but I think getting it depends on who you get cast as well.
Yes, I think it does. Yeah. I mean, with Tom Baker, definitely, yeah.
Yes, and that, as you say, you know, who you cast and who's in there as well will depend on who sort of brings Baker to life as well. Yeah. So I agree. I think it's not a bad story. I didn't mind it, but I did feel that it dragged. I was going to say, I think it's just a reminder that while people obviously like to say that Baker's era was golden, it wasn't quite always golden. Some nice ideas, but, you know, not even Bob Holmes can pull off classics every time.
I'm currently watching Underworld.
Oh dear, this first good episode, first part, I think is very good.
Yeah, I thought that as well. We'll continue that next week.
See how you go beyond that. Yeah, I'm not going to say anything more on that. This first episode is very good, very good.
Okay.
I've got Mind of Evil sitting for me to watch for some time.
Get it watched.
I know it's Mind of Evil I've got, and I've got another. I think is it the Dead Planet, one of the big Finnish ones, which is sitting on my Dark Planet. Sorry. Which end of this month is the Trenzalore book I've got ordered to see what that's like.
Mm. Okay, well, dear listener and James, that brings us to the end of the podcast this week.
Oh, good.
So thank you for joining us. Thank you for joining me in this kind of short notice. I feel like I'm in the sanitarium because I'm not the only poorly person in this house. I'm not the only poorly podcast person. So, so that's that. And we'll see you next... Oh, we won't see you. Why do I say that? You'll hear from us next time. Until then, goodbye.